So I'm very happy to welcome Earl Campbell to speak to us today. So Earl is currently at the AWS Centre for Quantum Computing, also been the University of Sheffield, and he's done some stellar work in various things, quantum information, including fault tolerance and magic states. And today he's going to tell us about random circuits and compilation.
Okay, thank you, Mike, for the introduction, and thank you for inviting me to speak at this seminar. So I've been to Perimeter several times in the past, often to these seminars in person. And as I was mentioning to Mike before we started recording, but the last conference that I went to was in Perimeter Institute in November. And since then, I haven't really traveled much at all. And so, yeah, that's an indication of the current situation. So yeah, it's a pleasure to tell you a bit about random circuits and their uses in compilation. So I should add that whilst I'm working for Amazon at the moment, I'm not quite in a position yet to tell anyone about the work that I'm doing with Amazon. And so I'm going to give you instead a kind of like review survey talk that I gave at another meeting a few weeks back. And it's going to be a kind of historical summary of some old work in the field, and then a few select results by myself and some other people. So, you know, each individual result I might only spend a few slides on. So it's more of a kind of survey talk. Okay. So here's my historical timeline. So I kind of imagine the 90s as being like antiquity, where the field began. You know, we had the first main ideas in the field. And then oddly, there was this kind of like almost dark ages period where there were, a few good papers, but really everything was working out the details of Soloveitch-Ataev or saying, some quite fundamental results, but no huge leaps in terms of practical compilers. So by compilers, I mean tools for, breaking quantum algorithms down into individual gates. That's the topic of the talk. And then you have this period, which I'm calling the Renaissance here. And it's not just me that calls it the Renaissance. In fact, there are numerous papers that you can read where they refer to this period as being the Renaissance in quantum compiling. And so there was this kind of explosion of results. And I think the thing that's really different in this period compared to the antiquity slash dark ages period is the focus on Clifford plus T gate sets, so a different gate set, whereas the previous results were just considering generic gate sets. And what this allowed people to do is to be driven by number theoretic insights. So I think there are some people on this call, including John Yards, who even know much more about this than myself. And so I'm just going to pick out a few select results during this period that I regard as very interesting papers that highlight the progress on Clifford plus T gate synthesis. And then, in the last few years, there's been this huge explosion in the field, it seems to me, in quantum computing in general, but in particular in this area of how do you compile an algorithm. And I'm going to talk about a specific subthread now, which starts to include my own work. So we'll start off with talking about a result by myself, but which coincided by a result with Hastings that had a lot of similarities. So this is a general result on how to use randomization in compilation problems. And then a bit later on, there's a group in Maryland who had a paper that specifically looked at how you can do Hamiltonian simulation using random techniques. So that got me interested in Hamiltonian simulation. So a year later, there's a solo paper by me and then a paper with a couple of postdocs in my group that look at two algorithms, which we called QDrift and SparStow, that also concern using randomization for the problem of Hamiltonian simulation. So I guess a fun thing to mention here, which I'll emphasize, is that this was the first algorithm that proved that you could perform Hamiltonian simulation with a gate complexity that's completely independent of the number of terms in the Hamiltonian. So previously, there was no known way of doing that, using randomization or not, but hopefully also the algorithm is of practical interest and merit. And then I'm gonna very, very briefly mention at the end a very recent paper by a collection of authors at Caltech that asked the question, what happens if I take a random compiler and I de-randomize it? So I look at a specific instance. And they were able to show that this property that I proved about the independence from the number of terms of Hamiltonian remains, but it's still, the algorithm's not random anymore. Well, it's a specific instance of a random algorithm. So in some sense, it's still random because it uses a random argument in the proof. Okay. So that's the brief kind of historical overview that we're going to go through in this talk. So we'll start off in the 90s, the antiquity in later Middle Ages period, reviewing some basic concepts. So we say a gate set is just some collection of unitaries that we use to build up circuits. So we've got a gate set, which is just a set of something, let's say A, B, and C. And we build a circuit. What we do is we basically form a sequence of these things, A, B, C, A, B, B, C, that one could call words. Oh, hang on. Keynote is playing up. Okay. So informally, everyone knows what universality is. Informally, it's just that a gate set's universal if we can implement any target unitary up to some finite precision by a sequence of gates from the gate set. A little bit more formally, it's universal if we have some target unitary and there's some desired level of precision epsilon, which is bigger than zero, and we can find a circuit, which is an element of this group, so some sequence of gates from the gate set, such that the distance between the target and the unitary that you implement is less than epsilon. So examples of universal gate sets include Clifford plus T and Clifford plus Toffoli. So we can also chuck a cost model on top. So a cost model is just something that says that for every gate in the gate set, you associate a real positive number that is the cost of that particular gate, and then the circuit, which is composed of a sequence of gates from the gate set, is just the sum of the cost of the individual gates. You just add up the cost of the individual gates. So two cost models that we'll talk about include the uniform cost model, where every gate has cost one, and the magic state cost model, where I say that if something's a T gate, it has cost one, but if it's a Clifford gate, it has cost zero. And I'll say more about T gates and Clifford group later if you don't know what those are. But okay, so I think of a unitary compiler as being some black box piece of software. It takes as input that some description of the target unitary and then the desired level of precision epsilon, and then it outputs some circuit U, which is composed of elements of the gate set, and it will have some level of precision. So here I'm talking about the infinity norm, but we're also interested in black boxes that come with some kind of promise. So some kind of promise that says that the cost of the circuit that it outputs is upper bounded by some function of the target precision. So here I'm calling this the promise function. And for an efficient compiler, we'll say the promise function is polylogarithmic, right? So it's going to be upper bounded by some constant times the logarithm of 1 over epsilon raised to some power gamma, some constant, which is important to know about, and we'll come to that. And we'll say a compiler is optimal if it has the lowest possible cost of implementing a particular unitary, or for instance, the lowest possible promise function. So, the celebrated Soloveitch-Kataev theorem tells us that there's an algorithm which will solve the compiling problem for any gate set, assuming there's some mild caveat, right? That the gate set, if it contains G, also has to contain G inverse. But given that, then there's an explicit algorithm that will solve the problem with a cost that's upper bounded by log 1 over epsilon to the power gamma, where gamma is some constant between 3 and 4. So I believe, but I've not read the original papers or email claims, that they just said that it was somewhere between 3 and 4. And the runtime is efficient in various variables. So it's efficient in the Hilbert space dimension and log 1 over epsilon. But note that the Hilbert space dimension is going to grow, right? So for a very large synthesis problem, like if you wanted to synthesize some arbitrary unitary in 100 qubit space, Soloveitch-Kataev is not necessarily going to do it. And the reason for that is that Soloveitch-Kataev works by taking matrix representations of unitaries and multiplying them together and asking, interrogating certain questions about these multiplied together matrices. So an important question here is, what is the constant gamma? And so there are two papers that I would like to highlight that look into this kind of Soloveitch-Kataev algorithm in more detail. So there's the Dawson and Nielsen paper that's an excellent review of Soloveitch-Kataev. And then also Aram Harrow has a lot of work on this in his undergraduate thesis. And they both explicitly show, and I mean, these are the main references for me for this result, that gamma is equal to 3.97. But this constant prefactor, the constant prefactor both in the runtime complexity and the cost, is going to grow with the Hilbert space dimension. So it's going to grow exponentially with the number of qubits. So this works well for modest numbers of qubits. So is solar vacatur optimal? Very early on, even in the ancient era of the field, the answer was known to be no. So this was shown by Harrow, Recht, and Chuang. And so they considered, you know, any universal gate set, and they showed that there will always exist a solution to the compiling problem with a cost that's upper bounded by log 1 over epsilon, big O. So here, there's no gamma, because gamma is equal to 1. And they were also able to show that this is optimal. However, they didn't give an explicit algorithm. They didn't show how you would solve the problem in a way that was any sense efficient. What they basically did was they said, you know, consider the tree that grows and gets exponentially larger, the tree of sequences of different circuits that I could possibly perform from this gate set. And they showed that there must exist at least one thing in this sequence of circuits that is epsilon close and uses this many gates, right? So it's really just an existence proof. It doesn't tell you how to actually solve the compiling problem in practice. But what it does really do is it sets up very early in the field this dichotomy between what we know is theoretically possible, which is solving compilation problems with gamma equal 1, and what is practically feasible for modest size Hilbert space dimension, which is Solovey-Kataev, where gamma is equal to 3.97.
Oh, sorry, can I just interrupt with a question? Yeah. In that previous slide, you were saying that this gamma scales in the 3.97, just one slide over, the 3.97 scales in the size of the unit tree, right?
No. Hang on. Okay, let me go back a second. Right. So you're going to have some promise, some cost that looks like big O log 1 over epsilon gamma, right?
Mm-hmm.
So gamma is a constant, but the big O is hiding a constant prefactor.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And the constant prefactor is going to depend on the Hilbert space dimension and other things.
Yeah.
So there's some constant that I'm not really talking about. But the gammas are a constant.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, which doesn't depend on the Hilbert space dimension. The constants are important as well, but for this talk, I just want to emphasize the scaling. You know, you've got a polylogarithmic function. So like, what's the gamma, right? What's the power that's above the logarithm of 1 over epsilon? That's what I want to kind of investigate. Okay, so all of that early work in the field was focusing on the general circuit synthesis problem for an arbitrary gate set. And then we come into this period, which I've kind of called the Renaissance. And the progress has really been driven by looking at this specific gate set. The gate set generated by T, C naught, S, and H. So the Clifford plus T gate set. So Clifford group includes C naught, the Hadamard gate, the square root of Z, and the T gate is the eighth root of unity in some sense. And so we're going to give cost 1 to T gates and cost 0 to anything that's Clifford. And this is well motivated by issues in fault-tolerant quantum computing, where it's easy to implement things that are in the Clifford group and hard to do things that are outside. But you can do T gates at some modest cost. Okay, so an early paper on the, so the first paper that I want to highlight was by Kolichnikov, Maslov, and Mosca. And so they looked at the single qubit Clifford plus T synthesis problem. And what they showed, what they gave was an efficient algorithm that could compute the optimal T count under some caveats. So the proof basically proceeds by writing the matrix down in terms of this ring, so in terms of products and sums of I and 1 over square root of 2. It only applies to single qubit gates, but it's an exact synthesis result. So what I mean by exact synthesis is that there are no epsilons on this slide anywhere. The assumption is, take some target unitary that you could precisely synthesize using some sequence of gates, some sequence of Clifford plus T gates, then this is how you exactly get that gate. It's efficient and it's optimal. Okay, so with some permutation of those authors and some new people on board, there was an algorithm for the T-count paper which looks at the n qubit version of this. So still Clifford plus T, but now more than one qubit. And they also showed how to compute a circuit that achieves the optimal T count. But if you look at the runtime, it's got a scary thing in it, right? It's got 2 to the n C of U. So if n is large, or C is large, or even worse, both of them, then the runtime of this algorithm is going to be poor. And so there are a few papers that have implemented this particular algorithm and have used it to prove that. So for instance, it's been shown that if you try to synthesize the Toffoli gates with Clifford plus T gates in a unitary fashion, then you'll need 70 gates. And that's very close to the limit of what you can do before the exponential component here gets unwieldy. So this works for any number of qubits, but again, it's exact synthesis. There are no epsilons on this slide anywhere. It's very inefficient, but it is optimal, right? So this is also what I'd say a very interesting result in this period. And the next one I want to mention is the Ross-Selinger algorithm. So here we're back to approximate synthesis, and there are going to be epsilons all over the slide. So the question is, given the gate set Clifford plus T, how do you approximate some single qubit rotation around the z-axis? And what they showed is that for any desired epsilon, you can always do this with a number of gates that's bounded by 4 log 1 over epsilon. I believe this changes if you go from worst case to average case. So this is only for single qubit z-axis rotations, but you can build other rotations out of that. It is approximate synthesis now, so it is kind of comparable to the Solovayev type results. It is efficient and it is optimal, so the gamma is equal to 1, right? So the cost, look above, is cost, I presume you can see my pointer, yeah? The cost of V is less than 4 log 1 over epsilon, so there's no power up here because the power is 1. So it's also a very practically useful algorithm, and in fact, they very helpfully put a command line tool on their website, and I've used it various times for various papers. It's probably too small to see, but it outputs something, some sequence of S, T, and H gates. And if you put something in that's of interest, like a target precision of 10 to the minus 10 or so, then what it means is that you've got a few hundred gates rather than tens of thousands of gates that you would have if you use Solovayev. I think this is really why people see this as the Renaissance period, because for decades, people were just citing the Solovayev algorithm, saying it solves the synthesis problem. But actually, the gate counts were very, very high. And then during this period, we saw that it was reduced by 2 orders of magnitude, very, very substantial improvement. Okay, so I think that there are a lot of important results that have happened throughout this big window of time that I've just summarized, but it still leaves many questions open. So what good heuristics might there be for multi-qubit synthesis? It's probably too hard to hope for practical optimal solutions, but you can look for good heuristics and implement them. What about specific tasks such as Hamiltonian simulation? And indeed, I'll come back to this later on in the talk. And what about the benefits of ancillary measurements? So what about the benefit of not just performing a sequence of unitaries, but using some ancillaries and making measurements? There are some nice partial results. In fact, we know that Toffoli can be implemented with 40 gates and not 7, but very little is known about optimality. It's very hard to prove anything. And what are the benefits of using randomness, not just using a sequence of unitaries that's deterministically selected? And that's going to be the main focus of this, the remainder of this talk, alongside Hamiltonian simulation. So before I can introduce any results on random compilers, I have to tackle the question of how do we measure noise in a random compiler? And before talking about unitaries or channels, I just want to kind of recap two important ways of measuring noise at the level of pure states. So the well-known metric, perhaps the most well-known one, is the fidelity. And if I ask what the fidelity is of this state here, phi 1, with respect to psi, then geometrically, what I can see it as being, at least in the Bloch sphere, is if I project phi 1 onto some axis defined by psi, and then I look at this distance along here, right? That gives me the infidelity, 1 minus fidelity. Another important measure is the one norm error. So the one norm, the Shatten one norm or trace norm, is just the sum of the absolute values, which can also be computed in this manner. So if I've defined this for some operator, then I can ask what the one norm error is between two states, density matrices or pure states, by just subtracting the two density matrices from each other and then computing the one norm. So if we kind of look at these two different measures, in the case of pure states, then what we see is that for pure states, actually, the one norm error is going to be something like the square root of the infidelity. So it's actually going to look much, much larger. But I would argue it's the thing that we should be interested in. I mean, I think a lot of people in quantum information accept that the one norm is a useful thing to know. And the reason for it is that it's the relevant thing for bounding errors in probabilities and expectation values. So if I want to measure some observable and I want to get a bound on what the error is of some expectation value or probability of some particular outcome, the error, let's say, if I use psi 1 instead of psi, then I can get such a bound if I know what the one norm is between these two things. I can't really get a bound from the fidelity except by proving a bound on the one norm from the fidelity. So the one norm is the relevant thing for kind of any statistics that you extract from a quantum computer, because it tells you how the probabilities of your approximation differ from the probability distribution you would see from the actual target state. So this tells us that we can improve things if we use mixing of different states. So if I've got, let's say, psi 1 and psi 2, which both have, you know, some fidelity with respect to psi, then I can improve the one norm error between psi and my state preparation by just tossing a coin and with 50% probability preparing psi 1 and 50% probability preparing psi 2, because this is equivalent to just preparing the state rho, which is much, much closer in one norm. So now, actually, the one norm error of rho is comparable to the infidelity. So I've kind of quadratically suppressed the error for free, in quotation marks, because I haven't used any additional resource other than mixing. And this is essentially the insight and trick that we're going to exploit for the rest of this talk. At the heart, everything is just this observation that when you're thinking about one norm, mixing brings you closer to a point. But to lift this to thinking about channels, or to, let's say, define the random compiling problem, we want to say there's some target unitary V and some precision epsilon, and the compiler has got to output some probability distribution of circuits. And I think about this probability distribution of circuits as being a channel, a random channel. So I sum over the probabilities of the different unitaries that I implement, and then I ask, what's the difference between this channel, which is an analog of a density matrix, and a channel version of the unitary, right? So I want some desired precision epsilon, and then I want to measure the minimize the cost. We just lift the cost. The cost could be like the worst case or the average cost of the unitary version of the problem. So I haven't said how you define the distance measure, and what we're going to use is the so-called diamond norm, which is really just telling us to take the maximum of the one norm error that's possible. So it's really the natural analog of the one norm, and it allows us to prove similar things as you could prove with the one norm. Any questions up to that point? Okay, so now I'm going to start presenting some results. So this is a result that I posted on the archive the same week as Hastings posted a very similar result that I've been sat on mine for a while, because I wanted to do some numerics and I never got around to them. And then when I saw his paper, I panicked and I had to put mine on very quickly. And so this is the ref by my paper is called Shorter Gate Sequences for Quantum Computing by Mixing Unitaries. And there's a reference for Hastings' paper as well. So just straight in to tell you what the main result is of this paper. So it assumes some unitary compiler, and it could be any unitary compiler. It could be for any gate set, provided it's universal, and it can have any cost measure associated with it. But it's going to be some black box that takes in a target unitary and some target precision, and then outputs a circuit built from gates in the gate set. And I'm also going to assume that it comes with some kind of promise, right? That the cost of the circuit it outputs is less than or equal to some function of the target precision. Then what we're able to prove is that there exists a random sequence of unitaries, an ensemble that I can sample from, that when I mix over it, it gives me this channel. And the diamond norm of error of this channel between the unitary and the channel above is less than or equal to some constant, which I got as being 10, but you could probably tighten it, epsilon squared. But the cost of the random circuit is the same, or is upper bounded by the cost that the black box unitary compiler would give you. And so what this is telling you, or to paraphrase, is that you can get quadratic error suppression up to a constant for the same cost. So this is a very, very general result. If one looks specifically at the problem of synthesis for single qubit axial rotations, then the assumptions can be relaxed and the inequalities can be tightened slightly. So if this tells you that you can get the same cost, at the same cost, you can get better error suppression, you can also turn it around and say, well, let's say that I want to fix the error suppression for the unitary compiler and the random one, then I can lower the cost. And it's really just like rearranging the epsilons and deltas from the above to get this corollary at the bottom. So let's say that the unitary compiler has this promise that the cost is bounded by A, you know, which is some constant that might, as Hakot was asking, depend on the size of the Hilbert space, but then log 1 over epsilon gamma, some constant that doesn't depend on anything. Then there exists a random circuit with a diamond norm errors upper bounded by epsilon, but now the cost is reduced by some factor c to the power of gamma. So I give an exact value for c here, but really the important thing is that when epsilon goes to 0, this is basically 2. So I have a saving, or the cost is reduced by a factor of 1/2 to the power of gamma. This is a very general result. Now let's ask, how does this help with specific applications? So if we look at the Ross-Selinger algorithm as a black box, then here gamma is equal to 1. And so you've got a resource saving of a factor 2, which is helpful. I mean, people really battle to improve these constant factors by 2 or 3 here and there for these single qubit synthesis problems, because they're so important in terms of resource counts for quantum computation. So for example, if these were the target precisions, then for 10 to the minus 10 precision, the optimal unitary solution, the optimal unitary compiler would use 300 T gates, whereas the random compiler would need 165 or less. So it's not quite a factor 1/2 because of the reason that C isn't exactly 1/2. Okay, now let's look at Soloveitch-Ataev. So for Soloveitch-Ataev, gamma was equal to 3.97. So now the resource saving is much higher, because it's 2 to the power of 3.97. So it's almost 16. So this means that, you know, there's a much bigger resource saving that's potentially there for using randomized compiling on top of, let's say, a less efficient compiler like Soloveitch-Ataev. But there are many problems where you might be stuck with something like Soloveitch-Ataev. Now, what if you wanted to try and, as good as you can, synthesize some circuit that was a 10-qubit circuit? It's still small enough that there's some hope that you could solve it with Soloveitch-Ataev. But as far as I'm aware, all of the other compilers on the market would really struggle to make any headway with it. So there you would have, you know, a fairly decent factor 16 improvement. So I'm going to sketch the algorithm. And the sketch of the algorithm also serves as a sketch of the proof if you work out all of the details. So again, we assume a black box compiler. And what we do is we have a target, which I'm going to geometrically denote by this red cross here. And then we run the compiler many times to get many different unitaries that are close to it within some distance delta that surrounds the point in some sense. Now, if the compiler acts deterministically, if you ask it to give you V, it might give you the same output every time, so you wouldn't get lots of points surrounding the target. So we have to fool the compiler in some sense by sending it a bunch of requests that are kind of spread around the target sufficiently far away that all of the answers that the black box compiler gives must also be surrounded around the target. So once we've got all of these different unitaries, we lift. And this lifting will probably also explain what the space is in the first point. So if I've got some unitary U1 that I know how to synthesize, which corresponds to the outputs of the black box compiler, then I can think about that U as being e to the iHt for some h, right? So this is what I mean by lifting from the unitary to the Hamiltonian. Now, Hamiltonians are things that I can add and get another Hamiltonian, so they form a space. So in this picture here in 2, really, you can think about H1, H2, H3 as being points in some vector space. And then the target I'm requiring to sit in the convex hull of H1, H2, H3. So part of what the proof does is it shows that we will always be able to find a bunch of these H's that surround the target. Once we've got a bunch of points that surround the target, so it sits in the convex hull, what that tells us is that we will always be able to write the target Hamiltonian as a sum of PJ HJs, where the PJs can be interpreted as probabilities. That is, they sum to one and they're all positive. So now what we simply do is we use these as the probabilities in our random compiler. And this condition exactly gives us the quadratic suppression and error. So like normally you would have like epsilon error, and now you have epsilon squared. And the reason for that is that in lots of, when you do various Taylor expansions, what you find is that to first order, you have some terms that look like this, but now they match H target, and so they disappear. It's a very quick sketch. So after this work, there was some work by a group of authors in Maryland that asked how you could use random techniques for Hamiltonian simulation. So in Hamiltonian simulation, you've got some Hamiltonian. We assume each of the components is normalized to one, and there's some coefficients that we're always going to take to be positive. And you want to approximate some unitary u is the exponential of I h t for some time evolution to t. And we say the gate set is built from, is given to you in some sense by the decomposition. So one gate is the exponential of I h j tau for any one of the h j's in the Hamiltonian. So for instance, these could be Pauli operators, and then each one of these gates would be not a rotation about a single qubit Pauli operator, but some multi-qubit Pauli operator. What that means is that it's Clifford equivalent to a single qubit axial rotation. So once you've kind of worked out the cost with respect to this, to get the cost in terms of T and Clifford gates, all you have to do is add, say, synthesis by Ross Selinger. And then, then you know how to do it in terms of Clifford plus T. So it's a reasonable cost model. And you know, the very well-known solution for tackling this is to use a Trotter-Suzuki product formula. And the first order of this, the first order of this formula is simply that you divide things up into R steps, and each individual step is a product over a rotation corresponding to each individual term in the Hamiltonian. So I like this graphical way of explaining things, and it'll help a bit more in the next few slides. So let's say that Hamiltonian is a sum of these terms, H1 through to H5. The H is themselves are normalized, and there's some weighting in front of them. Then when I do one step of time evolution, I kind of illustrate the constant prefactor in the constant in the exponent by the width of this pulse. You kind of think about it as how long the gate is turned on for. So you weight each pulse by the amount in the Hamiltonian, and then you repeat it many, many times. And this is what first order Trotter does. But the bounds, the error bounds that you get, doesn't depend on what permutation you choose, what order you choose for the terms in this particular step. So geometrically, what you have is that there's some target unitary, and then there's some ball around it, and a whole bunch of points all corresponding to different choices of first order Trotter formula solutions. They're all roughly the same distance. So if I mix over all of these, then we might hope by a kind of Campbell-Hastings style way of reasoning that I end up close to the target, and I have therefore quadratically reduced the errors. And indeed, that is the case. So an important caveat is that in a deterministic implementation, every single time I implement a Trotter step, it has to be exactly the same. But I have to sample a fresh permutation every single time I do it for each step of the randomized version. So you'll see here that each one of these steps has a different sequence of gates, or at least, they're not all the same. And then what Charles Ostrander Sue were able to show is that the gate complexity of first order randomized Trotter is significantly better than randomized deterministic Trotter. In fact, there's, for instance, epsilon drops to square root epsilon, and there's also improvements to L and T. So that's first order Trotter. They also show numerous, much more technical results for higher order Trotter formulas. And they numerically look at a 1D Heisenberg chain. So what you see is that for first order, there's a massive gap between deterministic and randomized. But then when you go to higher orders, the gap kind of closes a bit. Now, the higher order formulas, I haven't said what they are, but they get you improved asymptotic performance with respect to time and target precision epsilon at the cost of a worse constant prefactor. But the constant prefactor grows with the order, which means that in practice, actually, you probably want to work with second or fourth order. So you don't have to worry about the fact that the advantage disappears at sixth order. because you're probably not even working at SIP border anyway. So this tells you that randomization can be useful for Hamiltonian simulation, but maybe this isn't as amazing as you might hope for it to be. So then I started thinking about this problem, and I wanted to try and come up with some ways of building a random compiler that didn't really use maybe the black box mentality that I'd relied on before and weren't so closely attached to the standard Toronto Suzuki formulas. And so I'm going to present two things, one called QDrift, one called Sparsto. So again, we're looking at the Hamiltonian simulation problem. We want to synthesize e to the iHt. Particularly what I'm going to consider when describing QDrift is the setting where L, the number of terms in the Hamiltonian, is very, very large. So this is a relevance for things like quantum chemistry, where if you have a system that has, say, n potential electronic modes, then there's order n to the 4 interactions in the Hamiltonian. So, you know, as we saw a couple of slides ago, the gate complexity could depend on L squared. And so if, you know, L already depends on n to the 4, then you're looking at an n to the 8 dependence, which doesn't look very nice, right? So in one slide, the one slide summary of QDrift is that it has this bunch of assumptions. You've got some Hamiltonian, the HJs are normalized in an appropriate way, and there's some constant, and an important constant, that is just the lambda, which is the sum of each of the coefficients in the Hamiltonian. Then what QDrift tells us to do is we pick with probability PJ, which is proportional to the weighting of the Hamiltonian and normalized according to lambda. And with that probability, we implement a gate which corresponds to the jth term in the Hamiltonian, but where all of the other things in there are constant, all of these other values are constant and don't depend on J. And then we repeat this G times. So what you'll end up with, a specific instance of this random compiler, will give you a gate sequence that graphically looks like this, right? So I'm trying to emphasize with this picture that the width of each of these is constant, but what has changed is the frequency of them. So for a Hamiltonian where, you know, the blue term had a bigger weight in the Hamiltonian, it will occur more frequently in QDrift. So this helps you understand the intuition for why the gate complexity is improved, at least for Hamiltonians where there's a large spread in the weights of the various terms. And that's because if you look at a standard Trotter sequence, you know, there are these, say, yellow slices which have to be repeated once every step, but they only have a very, very small width. What's kind of happening in QDrift is that these are being merged into a smaller number of gates with the same duration. What one's able to prove then is that the gate complexity of QDrift scales as 2 lambda squared t squared divided by epsilon. So the dependence on lambda and t and epsilon is not amazing compared to some other algorithms out there. But I think the key thing that I want to emphasize is that it has no dependence on L whatsoever. I mean, there are some other approaches that have very little dependence, but it's still like log L or something. And so, you know, as far as I'm aware, it's the first algorithm that has a gate complexity that's completely independent of the number of terms in the Hamiltonian. And yeah, the proof, like, I really loved this, doing this paper, because I got a nice result, but also the proof was incredibly simple. So I'm just going to sketch a little bit of it for you. And it goes as this. The important insight is that you switch from thinking about unit trees as being channels, right? So I write down the kind of Liouville generator for the Hamiltonian, which is just this commutator. And then the unit tree viewed as a channel or a superoperator, I can see it as being the exponential of this generator times t. And if I Taylor expand this out, I get the identity, and then t times L, and then higher order stuff. So what I'm going to define is Lj, which is the commutator just for the jth term in the Hamiltonian. And then what you can see is that by linearity, L, the kind of desired generator, is equal to the sum of Cj, the term from the weightings in the Hamiltonian, and then Lj. Now, if I randomly select one gate, I kind of forget which gate it is that I apply, but I randomly choose one and I do it, then what I get is a channel, which is a sum of exponential tau Lj with some coefficient Pj, which is the probability that I've chosen this particular gate. Now, I could have set tau to have a dependence on J, but I haven't. So what one finds is then if I set PJ as proportional, as promised on the previous slide, to the coefficient in the Hamiltonian, then when I expand out to first order, I'm going to have a sum of CJ times tau over lambda LJ. Sorry. So I want the first order terms here to match the first order terms in the target unit tree. And using this fact here, that LJ is equal, sorry, the target generator is just the weighted sum of the generators that I have, I see that I'll get the right result to first order if tau divided by lambda is equal to T. So T is fixed, lambda is fixed, but tau is a free variable that I can freely choose. So I just set tau is equal to lambda T, and then these two expressions match to zeroth and first order. So that's really enough to maybe give you a bit of an idea that this works and what the proof is. Now, you have to do a little bit more work to bound all of the higher order terms, and you have to re-express it, not as a bound on the error, but a bound on the number of gates, but then you're done. But from this, you can probably already see that there's going to be no dependence on L, the number of terms in the Hamiltonian. And the reason for that is that each implementation of this channel uses one gate, not L gates. And L doesn't enter anywhere in terms of the error bound, so it shouldn't enter into the gate complexity either. So I also checked how this works for various molecules for, you know, over 40 qubits and got these plots. So the black line at the bottom is Q drift, and lower on the plot is beta. And the upper lines correspond to either randomized or deterministic variants of Trotter, where I looked at both first order, but also higher order formulas up to eighth order. And what you can see is that at low times, Q-drift has a big advantage. Now you've got five, this is, you know, log base 10 units on the y-axis. So here you've got one, two, three, four, I think it's five orders of magnitude here. That's a low T, what's the relevant T? So if you look at some papers that discuss phase estimation, then T is 6,000 is a kind of reasonable number to be looking at. Here you have about four orders of magnitude, but at larger T, you know, the advantage vanishes, and in fact, there will be a crossing point. But the thing to note is that this is a very high number of gates up here, right? This is 10 to the power of 24 or something. So whilst asymptotically in the regime of large T, you're going to see that conventional high-order Trotter formulas outperform Q-drift at modest T for systems with a large number of terms in the Hamiltonian. There are potentially many orders of magnitude improvement. Now, there are some caveats that I'd like to add, which is that when I made these plots in this paper from like 2 years ago, I used bounds on the Trotter Suzuki performance that came from the Charles Ostrander Su paper. And so they just, you know, used these bounds that depended on the largest weight in the Hamiltonian. But in fact, now I'm much more familiar with these so-called commutator bounds, which are typically much, much tighter. So a fairer comparison would be one where the Trotter bounds are expressed in terms of these commutator bounds. But one would still expect that there's going to be a crossover somewhere below the crossover Q drift is better, but it's just a question of where the crossover is. Another caveat is that everything that I'm talking about here is for chemistry problems, so there's a very large number of terms in the Hamiltonian. Some of the terms have a large weight, some of the terms have a very small weight. If you looked at a spin chain where the number of terms in the Hamiltonian scales proportional to the number of qubits in the system, and there's a fairly uniform distribution on the weights in the Hamiltonians, then any advantage that you might hope to get from this Q-drift approach completely disappears. It really depends on there being a variety of different weightings in the Hamiltonian. And of course, everything is expressed in terms of Diamond norm. And if you don't believe that the Diamond norm is a good measure of error, then you don't believe, well, yeah. And then these results are not relevant. Okay, so I just want to quickly highlight a kind of follow-up paper with a couple of postdocs in my group in Sheffield. And so what we were interested in here was trying to, in some sense, take Q-drift or come up with some randomized approach that had a better scaling with respect to time and epsilon and all of those variables that higher order Trotter formulas do well at. And the idea was to use something that we call Hamiltonian sparsification. So you take a Hamiltonian and you sparsify it. So you basically randomly drop out some of the terms in a way that depends on their weightings to get a sparsified Hamiltonian with a smaller number of terms. And you can kind of choose the amount of sparsification that you use. So in one limit, you can say, well, I'm going to keep all of the terms. then you implement Trotter having all of the terms and you have exactly Trotter. In the other limit, you say, well, I'm going to sparsify and I'm only going to choose one term. I'm going to do one step and then I'm going to sparsify again. I'm only going to have one term. It's going to be a different one. And I do Trotter again. And this becomes a lot more like Q-drift. So by tuning the amount of sparsification, you can interpolate between the performance of Q-drift and the performance of some higher order Trotter formula. And that's what these plots are essentially showing. So the blue line, so the axes are kind of switched around compared to the previous plot. But the important point is that lower down in the plot is better. The blue line is this new algorithm called Sparstone. And then the orange and the green lines correspond to Q-drift and higher order, and you know, some second order, I think we used, yeah, second order Trotter formula. So what you can see is that, you know, in one regime, you start to match second order. In another regime, you start to match Q-drift. But then there's this regime in between where you have, you know, you squeeze an order of magnitude performance out. So I think this highlights that there are other choices of random, there are other probability distributions that you can sample from to get your, you know, to build your random compiler that can have better performance with respect to parameters like time and epsilon. Okay, how are we doing on time? 44 minutes. Okay, so I'm nearly done actually. So I guess I've been evangelizing the benefits of random compilers and arguing that the diamond norm is a good measure of error. But some people, I suppose, you know, a lot of people like to know how something works in a way that's de-randomized or not happy with a diamond norm error and really, really want to know, you know, what's the fidelity between these two things, these two states or these two unit trees. And yeah, I come to the last paper that I'm going to cover in my survey, which is this paper by a group of people in Caltech. And yeah, they ask, what they were really keen to understand is why does Q-drift have this performance that's independent of the number of terms in the Hamiltonian, but there's no known way of doing that with a deterministic compiler. But if I can kind of have a deterministic compiler if I just sample from the random compiler and then just ask what is the error for that particular instance. So let me put that another way. Let's say that I'm going to the picture of states again. I've got some target psi and I've built a random compiler that randomly samples either psi 1 or psi 2 with probability 50-50. And I'm claiming that, you know, this is equivalent to preparing the state rho, and there's some particular one norm error between rho and psi. And the question that they're asking is, okay, if I sample and I get some instance psi 1, what's the one norm error of psi 1 relative to psi? Now, of course, it's going to be much, much larger, right? It's going to be, you expect it to be something like square root worse. That's the rough intuition. But if that's true, in a way that allows you to find a specific instance which requires a number of gates that doesn't depend on the number of terms of Hamiltonian, then you know something is possible with a deterministic compiler that that has so far only been proven in the randomized setting, yeah, or using density matrices. Okay, so their technique actually can be used for other things, not just Q-drift. You know, it's a general way of taking a random compiler and de-randomizing it. But the specific result that I want to highlight for de-randomized Q-drift is that with some probability delta, which you can choose to be as small as you like, the specific sampled circuit that you end up with has a diamond norm error that is less than epsilon whenever you use a number of gates that scales like this. The first term is the more important one. And it's got an n, which is the n from the number of qubits in the circuit, t squared lambda squared divided by epsilon squared. So directly beneath this, where I've written g q drift, I put the gate complexity for q drift. And it's, you can see there are some similarities. They both scale with t squared, they both scale with lambda squared, but the epsilon has got worse, right? So when you de-randomize, there's a price to pay in terms of epsilon. And this, I kind of think about it as being directly related to this fact that you end up with a square root whenever you start looking at a specific pure instance rather than the mixed one. But the thing that was surprising for me was that they got this N here as well, right? So this is some dependence on the number of qubits that are inside the circuit. Although there was another result in the paper where they were able to get rid of this N dependence completely. So they have something that looks, they were able to get rid of the N dependence. So the gate complexity is T squared lambda squared over epsilon squared. But they only get rid of it by considering not the distance between two unit trees, but the distance between two states. So they say, I think you fix an initial state and then you apply the target unit tree to it. And then you say, take a random unit tree and apply that to the same initial state and now compare the two states in one norm. And by doing that, you manage to drop this N dependence. Okay, so that was everything that I wanted to cover in this survey of many different things. Now to just give a kind of outlook to the future. So as I mentioned, when I had this result and Hastings had something similar on the archive and I kind of had to rush something out, I was pausing because I wanted to do some numerics. I wanted to implement what I had, do some experimentation rather than just have all of the theorems in the paper. And I never got around to that particular time, and I haven't got around to it since, and no one else has. So there's not just for any of my proposals, but for none of the proposals in the sphere of kind of random compiling, are there any software implementations that I'm aware of, or any kind of experimentation in terms of random protocols? And I think this would be especially interesting with respect to studying multi-qubit circuits, just because there are very few good compilers for things beyond one or two qubits. Very few kind of good general purpose compilers that aim to give some particular target unit tree. The other interesting thing here is that there's a connection to convex optimization. So once you write down a bunch of different unit trees that you know how to implement, and you start saying, well, how do I choose the probabilities? Then I've been giving theorems that say, well, if you choose the probability to be this particular number, then you get so-and-so result. But in fact, it's easy to see that the best probability to choose are fixed by some convex optimization problem. And convex optimization is easy. So there's like a natural kind of research program here, which is to try and enhance these ideas using convex optimization and see how they perform in practice. Another important bullet point is understanding the role of randomness in some cases like phase estimation. And so when you study phase estimation, you're not actually interested in the error of a whole bunch of unit trees producted together. You're interested in the error of your energy estimate. And a strange thing happens when you try to prove, say, the error in a phase estimation protocol. Say you've got access to some particular unit tree U and use that unit tree 1,000 times. Then the naive way to ban things would be to say, well, let's take the error on one instance of U and multiply it by 1,000. But in phase estimation, what you actually do is you say, well, if I have this unit tree U and I can think about it as being e to the I ht for some h that's an approximation of the target Hamiltonian, and then I get a bound on the, say, the infinity norm between the target Hamiltonian and the one that I've approximated. And once I've got that bound, that's good. If I repeat the unit tree 1,000 times, that error doesn't change. And the reason why I emphasize that is that this particular trick in proving bounds in phase estimation, it's not clear how you exploit that trick using a randomized protocol. And so for me, this is a big kind of gap in understanding how randomized algorithms can be used. The next bullet point is randomization in post-trotter, e.g. LCU circuits. LCU stands for linear combination of unit trees. And I've really just been summarizing trotter formulas and, but there's a whole other branch of tackling problems like Hamiltonian simulation, which people just broadly call post-trotter. And asymptotically, these tend to have much, much better performance. They're better scaling with respect to T, better scaling with respect to epsilon, everything. Although they all tend to require some number of ancillas and some constant factors that might look a little bit uglier. And I do know some problems where, you know, epsilon is large enough that it means that, in fact, it's better to use a trotter method. But still, you know, it prompts the question, can we use randomness in post-trotter circuits as well? And so far, I've not been able to do this. And the final bullet point is kind of very broadly, what about beyond IID probability distributions? So Q-drift is a pure IID probability distribution, right? So Q-drift says, pick a gate at random, do it. Pick a gate at random, do it. And just each gate you do, you've completely forgotten what you do previously. And I think the reason why it has no memory between what it does at different steps is connected to the kind of poor asymptotic performance with respect to time and epsilon. And there's a hope that one might be able to construct something like a higher order version of Q-drift that has the benefits of Q-drift, but also has the benefits of higher order trotter formulas. And, you know, my effort towards this hope was this paper that I mentioned with the algorithm Sparstow in collaboration with a couple of postdocs at Sheffield. And we were able to show something that interpolates between Q-drift and second order trotter. But I think that there's still scope for other kinds of probability distribution that have memory that's kind of, that have correlations all the way across the computation. So even in Sparstow, there was a limit to how different gates can be correlated because I perform a sparsification within one particular trotter step, and then I completely forget what I did in that step and do another one, use another sparsification. And so there's a limit to the range of the correlations. And it'd be interesting to maybe have some natural way of writing down a probability distribution that chooses a gate, like you can imagine a variant of Q-drift that says, choose a gate at random, but if you've chosen the same gate recently, don't choose it again. And to somehow naturally encode that in the probability that you choose it and then prove something about the gate sequence would be really, really nice. Okay, that's everything. Thank you for listening.
Great. Thanks, Earl, for a really interesting talk. Do we have any questions?
Yeah, Earl, if you go back quite a few slides where you had this picture of the bunch of approximate kind of unitaries around the target, and then you moved to the lifted picture of the algebra, yeah, where you had H in the... The complex.
This is the one that everyone asks a question about. Yeah.
So can you just maybe if you go to the three points you had there?
Yes.
If you just show me the third point, I just wanted to ask you something about the third point. So you find so you have these like H1, H2, and H3, and then you know the target lies in the convex space, and then you do some solving to find out what convex weights give you the best target. Can you just say something about how that solving happens? Like what kind of tools get used to do that solve?
Well, to find the PJs.
Yes.
I mean, I haven't said that, but that's probably the easiest part of the whole thing because it's just linear. It's just a linear set of equations.
But don't you have a lot of H's like surrounding? I mean, it's because it's a fixed size unitary, is it? So it's like just a finite problem.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes. So. Yeah, I guess there's an assumption, which is that you can compute what these H's are once you've got the unitary. Yeah. So it's got to be a small enough problem that you can do that. But so if we think about what's happening with the Hamiltonian simulation versions of these, usually the gate just looks like, I mean, the gate is given to you in the form e to the I hj anyway, right? So there are lots of instances where you automatically know what these hjs are. So I mean, this linear set of equations, let's say that you've got a triangle and it contains the target point, then there's only going to be one solution for what the PJs are. If it's a square, right, then there's going to be multiple solutions. And in fact, you can also imagine settings where, like, you know, you try to run this and it doesn't quite work out, and the red cross is like slightly outside the triangle, which is also possible. And really what you want to do is you want to actually minimize the distance between some point that you can mix over in these and the red cross, right? So the way that you would write it is just as a convex optimization problem. You would say, minimize the one norm of H target minus, you know, my combination of HJs, subject to a constraint that PJ sum to one, and each PJ is larger than zero and each PJ is less than one. And that's just a, it, you can just rewrite that as a linear problem. Yeah.
Thanks.
Hello Debbie.
Sorry. The question that I want to let you finish first.
Oh no, I was just gonna. I am finished. Yeah.
So a more clarifying question here. Your randomized compilation using the intuition that you can use two pure state to approximate a further away pure state by mixing. Mm-hmm. Does it only occur inside your compiler, but then in the fair end of the day, your circuit, is it really mixing up different circuits to approximate the target circuit, or it's just in the compilation process that you use randomness, but then you produce finally a circuit that approximate better the target circuit in the end?
Yeah, it's quite hard to get intuition for. I think I would say that there's an element of both of those things, yeah? So imagine that I use the random compiler to compile some subpart of a quantum computation, yeah? And then I did it again and again and again, and I asked, what's the total error of the whole over the whole computation, yeah? Then you would use, let's say, a diamond norm bound, for example, and just sum the errors in each part, right? Now, if you use the deterministic compiler, there might be a risk that you over-rotate or under-rotate for one of those subroutines, yeah? Mm-hmm. And if you call the same subroutine again, you would do the same over or under-rotation, and then you do the same thing again, right? So that at the end of the algorithm, all of those over or under-rotations have added up or cancelled away in a, you know, added up in a bad way, yeah? Whereas if you choose them randomly, that's very unlikely to happen, right? So this is an argument. I mean, intuitively, you would expect that they don't add up to the worst case anyway, that in some sense, it'd be like a square root saving in the sense of a random walk, right? Mm-hmm. But through, you know, by using a randomization argument, you can really prove that. So there's that aspect, but then there's also the thing that I think, which is important, that it really is the case that, you know, the point rho is closer in space than any of the individual states that you have, the pure states, yeah? Uh-huh. What does that mean when you make one execution of the computer, you actually get a pure state or a pure unitary, right? Mm-hmm. What it means is only really relevant when you execute the quantum computer more than once, right? So if I compile the algorithm and I get an outcome, when I run it a second time, what I'm telling you, it's important that you resample, right? That you recompile randomly to get the results that I'm describing. Mm-hmm. Okay. And the reason for that comes back to this. Let's see if I can get my navigate back up. Okay. So you can see this picture now, right? Where I'm... Okay, let's say, you want to, let's say, measure the expectation value of something. Then you're going to have to run it many, many times and compute an average.
Right. This is the reason why I get very curious, because it never occurred to me earlier that the Diamond-Long distance assume that we, or the trace distance for states, assume that we have no side information. Say, if someone actually pick up the piece of trash in the lab, knowing which random outcome has been chosen in the mixture, then they can distinguish whether you have the state psi or phi one versus phi two much better. Now, if I think about this in the in compiling circuit for computation, that becomes very odd, because your computation is either correct with high probability or not.
So in a sense, it does become a statement about high probability, which is what this last result about the Caltech, by the Caltech group is saying. Yeah, they're saying that if you take a randomized compiler, you can still get some of the results by looking at a specific instance. But of course, you can only make the statement with high probability or not. So maybe I can make the point with these, like phi one and phi two again, right? So let's say that psi, the actual state, has expectation value close to zero if you were to measure the observable x. Phi one and phi two have very large and very small expectation value respectively. Yeah. So if I just sample one of them and measure it many times, then I'll get the wrong outcome, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But let's say I do this 100 times, roughly 50% of the time I get phi one, roughly 50% of the time I get phi two. I get the expectation value for both of them, and then I'll weight them accordingly, and I get something that's very close to the correct expectation value, zero. Mm-hmm. Now, if we say that the experimentalist goes and looks in the bucket and discovers the side information, yeah? Mm-hmm. And the side information says that they had 100 instances of the same sample and zero of the other, then that's very unlikely to have happened. But when they discover that information, you're quite right. They know that the device has probably performed very poorly. That's a very, very unlikely thing to happen. With high probability, when they look in the waste bin basket, what they're going to find is close to 50-50 distribution of phi 1, phi 2 instances. Yeah. And they're going to say, oh, well, you know, that's a typical occurrence. The results are probably fine.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Thanks. Is that help? Yep.
Do you have any further questions? So I have a question. I remember one time I was talking to David about this, and he was saying that it was hard to improve on your Q-drift algorithm. But then you're suggesting there's lots of different ways you could do it. So is it like proving it is hard for these extensions?
There's lots of different ideas that have gone nowhere.
Mm.
Yeah, the thing about Q-drift is that the proof is exceedingly simple. It's like, well, the simplest proof I've written in about 3 years or something. And I think that, hang on, where is it again? Yeah. It's very, very simple. And one could then try and cook up other probability distributions that have, I feel like I want to have the proof open, but it's not necessary. One can try and cook up other probability distributions, and then the proofs get harder. Maybe it's just that I don't know enough about probability distributions and random variables. Like what I do think it would, well, the sparsification method did work, and it did improve on Q-drift, right? But it was, there was like a window where it improved, and then outside the window, it didn't help. And so there's a regime where it was the same as Q-drift, there was a regime of improvement, and there was a regime where it didn't help. And that last regime where it didn't help, so the regime of like high T values, that's the regime where one is hopeful that you would be able to like really push into and have an improvement using something that's randomized, that's like a true high order version of Trotter. But I'm not sure, like I'm not even sure what the probability distribution would be. It'd be something like, I'll try and sketch what I think it should be. Yeah. So let's see. Okay. Okay, so what's going on in this proof of QDrift is that you're sampling many, many times, right? And you end up with a sum over J. So each one of these J's indicates one of your samples, yeah? Mm-hmm. And I can think about this LJ as being like a random variable, right? Where the PJ is its probability. And they're all picked independently. And I know that the expectation value of this thing is exactly what I want. So then there's some higher order terms, yeah? Mm-hmm. The higher order terms are in some sense like the variance of how much you're deviating from the actual target, right? And so because I'm picking all of these to be, you know, IID random, then, you know, I'm not going to be too far away. The variance is going to be too large, but it's also not going to be super small. So one can imagine like trying to tighten this up, saying, well, I pick the first random variable completely at random, yeah? And the second one, now I have a bit of information. I know what the first one was. So now I want to tune things such that the first thing that I've already sampled plus the second variable, on average, give me the target. And then I keep doing this over so that everything is every sample is correlated to the previous ones. I've basically put in by hand that the expectation value is the correct thing. So that tells me that it should also behave correctly at first order. And it feels like it should have lower variance because it's self-correcting. You're always choosing the, like you can imagine a random walk, right? Where it says, you know, walk randomly, but if you're like above the line, then bias towards going down. If you're below the line, bias towards going up. Then you're going to hug the line much more closely. And what that suggests to me is that, you know, using such a technique, you should be able to tighten things up and get, you know, much better error bound. But yeah, so I know what the protocol probably is that does the job, but I don't know how to prove it.
And did you test anything like that numerically?
No, I've not tested it. I've not tested it. No. Simon, Simon Benjamin has tested something vaguely similar. Mm-hmm. Like he, and maybe also in a different context, it was like VQE or something. You mentioned this to me once where he was thinking about like a similar thing where you randomly sample gates. It was a sufficiently different context that I'm pretty sure he won't mind me mentioning this here, but it was like a different context where you sample some gates and you basically just say, if I get the same thing that I had in the previous sample, then I throw it away. So it's like a closed window. So you sample from the subset of things that you haven't had in some particular time window.
Yeah.
And just, you know, do it that way. And then, you know, whatever particular problem that he was looking in, he found this did like slightly better than just randomly sampling in a completely IID way. But yeah, you know, it would be a fairly easy thing to check. Mm-hmm. Numerically.
Yeah, so these kind of ideas have also been applied for more NISC stuff as well, because you're focusing on like...
In the NISC setting, this thing that I'm talking about was used in the context of trying to generate an ANSAT circuit, mm-hmm. but using a little bit of randomness. What was it? So, yeah. I mean, maybe I shouldn't say too much about that because I'm talking about someone else's work and I can't remember if they've actually put it in the public domain or not.
Okay, I'll have a look at Simon. So
yeah.
Google
Scholar. It's not exactly the same problem.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thanks. And if there are no more questions, let's thank Earl once again for the great talk.
Okay.